Welcome to TudorCast, a podcast dedicated to Tudor history. Hello and welcome to TudorCast for February 2008. I'm your host, Laura Akins, owner of TudorHistory.org and the Tudor Talk email list at Yahoo Groups. Let's get started with a recap of some of the Tudor news since the last podcast. It was a fairly light news month outside of some entertainment and book news. The main story is that the Church of England bought the only surviving copy of the warrant issued for the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots. The warrant will go on display in the library of Lambeth Palace, the London residence of the Archbishop of Canterbury. In book news, I've posted links to the pre-order of Alison Weir's next Tudor novel, this time covering the story of Elizabeth I in the years before she became queen. That part of Elizabeth's life has always been the most interesting to me, so I'm really looking forward to this one. I really enjoyed Innocent Traitor, so I'm expecting this one will be good as well. I've also posted a link to a new title from Susan James on Catherine Parr. She wrote a book on Henry VI's queen in the late 1990s, so I'm not sure if this is an update to that book or new work entirely. In DVD news, the BBC production of The Other Boleyn Girl is finally being released on DVD on its own here in the US. It was previously available as a bonus disc in one of the releases of the BBC's Six Wives of Henry VIII series from the 1970s. Of course, the timing is good, since the big screen version starring Natalie Portman and Scarlett Johansson will be out at the end of this month here in the US. The last bit of news that I wanted to mention this month is the curious influence the Tudors seem to be having on the new fashion lines on display. I've seen a couple of articles come through my Google alerts at how some of the fabrics and colors were Tudor influenced, but sometimes the influence is a little more direct, such as having images of Henry VIII and Mary I as princess on your underwear. I encourage folks who are curious to take a look at the articles that I've linked to in the news blog. It almost has to be seen to be believed. For links to source articles for the news recap and other past Tudor news, please see the archives of the news blog at tudorhistory.org/blog. Now for this month in Tudor history, where I feature some well-known and maybe not as well-known Tudor history events that took place during this month. On February 20th, 1547, at age 9, Edward VI was crowned king in Westminster Abbey following the death of Henry VIII on January 28th. For this month, I decided to read some of the entries from Rosalie's Chronicle from the proclamation of Henry VIII's death through to the celebration of Edward VI's coronation. The text is from the Camden Society's 19th century publication of the Chronicle, which can be downloaded from the Internet Archive since it is now in the public domain. I'll post a link in the show notes for those who are interested. These excerpts start on January 31st, 1547. Immediately the said lords in their order, with Garter, the King of Heralds, and other, in their coat armors, came out of the Parliament chamber into the palace of Westminster Hall with a trumpet, and their proclamation was made by the said Garter under the king's broad seal, Edward VI, son and heir of our late sovereign lord, to be king of this realm of England, France, and Ireland, defender of the faith, etc., and of the churches of England and also of Ireland, of the supreme head immediately under God on earth. Also that day at 10 o'clock, the mayor and aldermen assembled in the Guildhall in their scarlet gowns, and Clarentius, one of the king's heralds, two other heralds, and a trumpeter, and so rode from thence with my lord mayor and aldermen to St. Magnus Church Corner, where proclamation was made by Clarentius, after the blowing of trumpet two times, under the king's broad seal, Edward VI, with the death also of Henry VIII, the king's majesty's father, and so from thence they rode in order to Leadenhall by the Standard in Cheap, and to the Conduit in Fleet Street, where also the said proclamation was made. The same day, in the afternoon, the King's Majesty Edward VI came to the Tower of London from Hereford, and rode in at Aldgate. and so along the wall by the crossed friars to the Tower Hill, and entered at the Red Bulwark, where Sir John Cage, Constable of the Tower, and the Lieutenant received His Majesty on horseback, the Earl of Hertford riding before the King, and Sir Anthony Browne riding after the King. And on the bridge next the ward gate, my Lord of Canterbury, my Lord Chancellor, with other lords of the council, received His Majesty, and so brought him to his chamber of presence, where they were sworn to His Majesty. Our late Sovereign Lord, King Henry VIII, had declared by his will, under his great seal, his dearly beloved son and heir, our Sovereign Lord, now Edward VI, to succeed his crown imperial, the Earl of Hertford, Sir Edward Seymour, to be Lord Protector and Governor of the King's Majesty and of this realm of England until the King's Majesty came to his lawful age of 18 years. And ordained also by his will for his Privy Council, my Lord of Canterbury, my Lord Chancellor, my Lord of Durham, with others, as by His Majesty's will appeareth, to have the governance of this realm for the time. The 4th day of February, in the afternoon, a proclamation was made with a herald in his coat armor, a trumpet, and a common crier with his mace for the King's coronation to be the 20th of February next coming. The 14th day of February, the corpse of King Henry VIII was solemnly, with great honor, conveyed in a chariot, with his image lying on it, towards Windsor, and rested that night at Sion, where was a rich hearse made of wax 9 stories high. The morrow, being the 15th day, it was conveyed to Windsor, where at the town's end the Dean of Windsor, with all his choir and rich copes, with Eton College, met the corpse, and so was conveyed to the college in the King's Palace at Windsor, where it was set under a rich hearse of wax of 13 stories high, and was buried the morrow after Mass in the choir, where his late wife Queen Jane lieth. The 19th day of February, the King's Majesty rode from the Tower to Westminster through the City of London, which was richly hanged with rich cloths and diverse pageants, the conduits running wine, the crafts standing in their rails, and the alderman and lord mayor riding in crimson velvet gown, with a rich collar of gold, with a mace in his hand, after the King. And when His Majesty came where the alderman stood, the recorder made a proposition to His Majesty, and after the chamberlain gave His Majesty a purse of cloth of gold for a present from the city, which he thankfully took. This month of February was levied amongst the citizens of London for the King's coronation a benevolence after the manner of a 15 and a half. The 20th day of February, being Sunday Quinquagesima, the King's Majesty Edward VI, of the age of 9 years and 3 months, was crowned King of this realm of England, France, and Ireland within the Church of Westminster with great honor and solemnity, and a great feast was kept that day in Westminster Hall, which was richly hanged, His Majesty sitting all dinner with his crown on his head. And, after the second course was served, Sir Edward Dymock, knight, came riding into the hall in clean white complete harness, richly gilded, and his horse richly trapped, and cast his gauntlet to wage battle against all men that would not take him for the right king of this realm. And the King drank to him, and gave him a cup of gold. And after dinner the King made many knights, and then he changed his apparel, and so rode from thence to Westminster Place. The 21st day were great jousts with running at the tilt, and the 22nd day was fighting and turning at the barriers, where was many noble feats done. And now for a page from the Tudor History Glossary. This month we're up to N for New Year's Day and New Year's Gifts. First up, New Year's Day, which, not too surprisingly, is January 1st. However, it is a bit more complicated than that, since the calendar date often changed on March 25th, which is why you sometimes see two different years given for things that took place between January 1st and March 24th. As an example, Elizabeth I died on March 24th, and today we write that as March 24th, 1603. However, to her contemporaries, her death would have been written as March 24th, 1602. Of course, this can lead to some confusion when you're reading old texts. It wasn't changed in Britain and the colonies until the middle of the 18th century, which is why also you'll see sometimes George Washington's birth date written as February 22nd, 1731-2. And now on to New Year's gifts, which were given on January 1st and were basically the equivalent of Christmas gifts in the Tudor court. The giving of gifts by and to the monarch had a formal pattern to it, with the gifts reflecting the wealth and station of the giver. The higher your rank and wealth, the larger your gift. There are detailed inventory rolls of gifts from the reigns of most of the Tudors, which is a valuable source of information on plate, jewels, household items, and fashion. Part of Elizabeth's New Year's gifts rolls were published in the Palaces and Progresses of Elizabeth I, and you can read them online at www.larsdatter.com/gifts. I'll also put a link in the show notes. Here's just a sampling from the rolls. A lot of the entries are amounts of money in small silk, satin, or velvet purses, but there are a few other interesting items in there. From 1561 to 62, from the Earl of Warwick, a smock wrought with black silk, a pair of sleeves, and a partlet with gold, silver, and black silk. By the Lady Knowles, a fine carpet of needlework. By the Lady Fitzwilliam, widow, one petticoat of purple satin. By the Lady Gresham, a box with four sweet bags in it. By Mrs. Skipwith, a cushion cloth wrought with black silk and fringed with gold and purple silk, with a pin pillow embroidered. By Mr. Thomas Hennage, one hourglass garnished with gold with glass sand and in a case of black velvet embroidered with silver. By Lawrence Schreff, grocer, a sugar loaf, a box of ginger, a box of nutmegs, and a pound of cinnamon. And from 1588 to 89, from the Lady Marquess of Northampton, a pair of bracelets of gold containing 16 pieces, four enameled white set with one pearl in a piece, and four sparks of rubies apiece, the other four set with one daisy and a small ruby in the midst thereof, and four small pearls and eight long pieces between them, each set with small diamonds and two sparks of rubies. By the Countess of Bedford, two large candlesticks of crystal garnished with silver gilt painted. By the Baroness of Sheffield, one saddle cloth of black velvet embroidered all over with Venice gold, with all the furniture belonging for a saddle. Now it's time for a segment where I feature a text from the Tudor period. Since I've already read a lot of primary source material this month, I thought I would put a song in for the text segment. It's actually been a while since I've done this, so I thought it would be time to do another. This is Come Again, Sweet Love Doth Now Invite by John Dowland, performed by La Primavera, and I'll post the lyrics in the show notes.
Come again, sweet love doth now invite. Graces that refrain to lure me due delight to see, to hear, to touch, to kiss, to die with thee again in sweetest sympathy to see, to hear, to touch, to kiss, to die. Again, that I may cease to mourn through thy unkind disdain, for now left and forlorn, I sit, I sigh, I weep, I faint, I die in deadly pain and endless misery. I sit, I sigh, I weep, I faint, I die in deadly pain and endless misery. Gentle love, draw forth that to approve by sighs and tears more hot than are thy shafts. Did tempt while she for triumph laughs. By sighs and tears more hot than are thy shafts. Did tempt while she for triumph laughs.
And now for some closing comments. First up is this month's featured website, thepeerage.com. Anyone who's listened to past podcasts has probably seen the clues that I'm a genealogy buff, both for my own family and for the Tudors and other noble families. When I was making some charts for the website, one great resource for double-checking my information was this month's featured site, thepeerage.com. It also came in handy when I got a submission to the question and answer blog about the descent of the current Queen, Elizabeth II, from Bess of Hardwick. And if anyone's curious about the connection, it's from Bess's Cavendish children through her second marriage. It's really easy to get lost playing around with a site like this because there's so many other interesting tangents that you can get distracted by. But I encourage anyone with royal and noble genealogy interests to check it out. There isn't a whole lot more to add this month. It's been very busy for me at work this month, so I'm really glad that I was able to get this in on time. I'm planning to take spring break off in mid-March, and other than a quick trip to Houston, I'm planning on being home and catching up on movies, reading, and needlework. My goal is also to get the March podcast done that week so I can hopefully continue the plan of sliding the podcast towards the beginning of a month instead of at the end. If you want to comment on this podcast, you can do so at tudorhistory.org/podcast or send me an email at lara@tudorhistory.org. A transcript of this and previous podcasts are also available at the website, as well as links to MP3s of all the episodes. Log on to magnatune.com to listen to and purchase music from the artists that you heard featured in this podcast. I'll have a complete rundown of which albums I used in the podcast notes. Until next month, fare thee well.